In this part of the show, we will be talking about a natural resource that is very, very important, something that we depend on, could not get along without. But it's also something that we don't think about very much, and we don't talk about very much, certainly not as much as we should, and that is water. And very specifically, what we want to talk about this morning is groundwater. A lot of people in this country depend on groundwater as their source of fresh water. They drink it, they use it in agriculture, they use it in industry. And over the past few years, you can see that more and more groundwater is being pumped out. It's being used at an ever-increasing rate. And the concern is, for among some people who follow this issue, that we are acting as if it was inexhaustible, that it just can't run out, partly because it comes from deep under the ground. It's sort of mysterious. It's not like surface water. We can't see it. So we have this idea in our heads that, well, we can just have as much as we want, and we can continue on taking it that rate forever. People who indeed keep track of water issues say that is not true. That in fact, we are, in many cases, we're drawing down aquifers faster than they recharge. And that there are very serious environmental consequences. Things that indeed we can see and we will see if we continue to do that. This morning, in this hour of the show, we're talking with Robert Glennon. He has written a lot about water issues. He is one of the country's leading authorities on water law. He's professor of law and public policy at the University of Arizona. And he's authored a book on this subject. It's been out for about a year. The title of his book is Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters, and it is published by the Island Press. And if you're interested in that subject, you certainly should head down to the bookstore, the library, and look for the book. He's here visiting the campus. In fact, he's going to be giving a talk on some of these very issues, the things we'll be talking about. And that'll be taking place on the U of I campus. It's sponsored by the College of Law. We can talk about that a little bit later. As we, of course, discuss this issue now, questions and comments, they are certainly welcome. And all you have to do to be a part of the conversation is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That means if it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving. But anybody can call. That's 800-222-WILL and locally 333-WILL. Well, thank you very much for being here.
David, thanks so much for having me on your show.
How many people in this country and to what extent do people depend on groundwater as their source for fresh water?
Right now, it's over half of Americans drink groundwater drink groundwater as their domestic supply, and that's up quite a bit. Groundwater, in fact, is now over one quarter of the entire water supply. That includes industry, it includes farming, but the domestic supply is really shot up, and that's the figures I'm quoting, David, are older figures. And as the drought that has beset the country over the last 5 or 6 years has continued, people have been scrambling in search of new supplies, cities, farmers, industry, individual homeowners. And what they've often done is turn to groundwater.
And there are some now, so you were talking about kind of overall average figures. I think there are also particular places in the country, particular states, where their dependence on groundwater is even, isn't it even greater than that?
Oh, yes. There are some states where it's 90% of the people in the state rely on groundwater for the drinking water supply. Mm-hmm. And your setup was great. I mean, what an overview you gave your listeners. Because there was this theory that groundwater was literally inexhaustible, that groundwater existed beneath the surface much in the way the Great Lakes did, and that it was about of the same scale. Well, since those quaint notions existed, we've had the rise of the science of hydrology, and those folks tell us a very very different and very sobering story. Groundwater is water that's percolated into the ground over millennia, and what we are doing is pumping it out a heck of a lot faster than it's naturally recharging. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of an aquifer as a giant milkshake glass, and I think of each well as a straw in the glass. And what the law in most American states permits is a limitless number of straws in the same glass. So it's a finite supply, but limitless access to it. And that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. And I think it's worth commenting on that. Often when you think about water issues and people, particularly people having conflict over water, you think of this as being a Western thing. But in fact, concerns about groundwater and the level of groundwater use, this goes from one end of the country to the other. And even here, to take your metaphor, I know that here in this area, people are concerned about the pace of growth and future growth. And they know that here, just where we are, there are likely to be more straws. There can be people wanting to put in more straws. And they're saying, now look, we have to consider how we're going to manage this resource because a lot of people depend on it. And, you know, this questions of who gets to tap it and how much they get are very important ones and probably ones that you should start talking about before people start drilling.
Well, absolutely, because once people have the wells in, it's kind of too late. Particularly a large-scale agricultural production well could cost upwards of $200,000. Well, once that well's in place, it's unlikely to be turned off, the pump for that well. So you're absolutely right, David. And one of the problems we have in the area of water law is a disconnect between the science and the law. Surface water is pretty tightly regulated, especially in the West. But even so, even also in the East and the Midwest, with permit systems that restrict diversions from rivers and lakes. But groundwater in most states is governed by what's called the reasonable use doctrine, and it's anything but reasonable. It's basically, if you want to take it out of the ground, you go right for it. And I've been shocked at the number of problems that are existing in the Midwest that relate to over-exploitation of this resource.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about the way that the water is used, because I think that's something that people can relate to, and you deal with some of these stories in the book. Well, let's talk about French fries, because here's something that everybody sort of can relate to, and this is definitely a Midwestern kind of chapter here in this story.
It is. This is about a story of a river, the Strait River in Minnesota, and it's about a change in consumer habits, and it's about a change in water use, and it's one that we all get, which is eating French fries. Mm-hmm. Turns out potatoes are almost all water, and one of the geniuses of Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, was to recognize that if you wanted to make a great French fry, you needed to start with a potato that had a high water content. And the reason is kind of ironic and not very healthy, but when you make a French fry, what you do is you take the water out and you replace it with fat. And that's why it tastes so good. It's also why it's obviously not very healthy. And McDonald's, for marketing reasons, in the mid-80s, shifted from selling French fries in little wax paper bags that would fall over and make a bit of a mess into marketing them in supersized containers. And they're the familiar container with the flat bottom and the rigid sides. From that point on, in order to satisfy McDonald's rigid standards for uniformity, potato farmers needed to irrigate. Because if you irrigate, you get French fries that are perfectly uniform. They have the same uniformity as your computer terminal or your wristwatch or the automobile that you drive. And that produces a fry that is pure white, that is blemish-free, and this is the part I love, that is especially the right uniform length, namely the length necessary to stick out of the supersized carton so that the potato will be seized between thumb and forefinger by the consumer and dipped in the ketchup. And they're, of course, pumping from wells that are adjacent to a river and threatening the river. One of the things that's interesting to me about this and why the book is called Water Follies is potatoes grow perfectly well elsewhere in the country, and even in Minnesota, without using irrigation. But the irrigation allows for this uniformity. And I just think it curious. Are we American consumers so fastidious that we would not eat French fries that had slightly different colorations or were slightly different lengths. And so that's a kind of an odd way to use large quantities of water. The second thing, David, is that it's a huge change. No one in the West, no one except in the West, used to irrigate land. Of course, you have to in the West because it is so arid. But farmers in the Midwest and the East and the Southeast used to just rely on whatever Mother Nature provided. But now you're seeing, as the story in Minnesota suggests, farmers using groundwater to supplement what Mother Nature provides.
Hmm. Well, there is now, there's an environmental angle to this, to the whole story, but to this specific story. There has been a consequence to this intensive irrigation that they have been doing in Minnesota.
Yes, and the whole theme of my book, Water Follies, is about the impact of groundwater pumping on the environment. And it turns out that pumping groundwater has profound consequences on surface waters, on lakes, on rivers, on wetlands, on estuaries, on springs, on fens. And in Minnesota, it's a river. It's a blue ribbon trout stream, and the waters are being drawn down by adjacent groundwater pumping. And that's something that maybe, if I may, elaborate on, because it's not real obvious that this should occur. And the problem with groundwater pumping for us to figure out is we really can't see it. It's out of sight and out of mind. But groundwater is critical to supplying flows to rivers and lakes. And I'd ask your listeners to think of it this way. How do you solve the following riddle? If it hasn't rained for a while, where does water in a river come from? And the answer is it comes from the ground. The water is moving subsurface laterally toward the river. That's why if you look around, the river's always at the low point in the area, and it's the surrounding uplands that are providing very slowly, very gradually, very consistently, water to provide flow to the rivers and lakes. So if you pump down that water in the surrounding soil, all of a sudden you deny the rivers and lakes of this critical supply.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of the program. We're talking with Robert Glennon. He's professor of law at the University of Arizona and has written a lot about water issues. He's a leading authority on water law. He's author of the book Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters, and is published by the Island Press. Deals with this issue. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He's here to take part in a symposium sponsored by the U of I College of Law dealing with private property and the public interest. And this is taking place this afternoon from 2 to 5, the symposium titled Owning Nature, Private Property and the Public Interest, taking place in the auditorium of the law school that's on 504 East Pennsylvania in Champaign. It's also co-hosted by the Environmental Law Society, and this symposium is free and open to the public, so people here in and around Champaign-Urbana listening to us are interested in stopping by. Our guest here, Robert Glennon, will be one of the speakers. They should feel welcome. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have here a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm glad you're here.
Thanks.
Even though the subject that you're speaking on is a little bit outside general public knowledge, for those who are interested, the knowledge is there. For those who are concerned about creating a groundwater use policy, the alternatives are there, but isn't what is standing in your way politicians of all stripes who can't see beyond their next election and won't do anything for fear of alienating one or more groups of voters and campaign contributors?
That's a terrific question, and also I gather a comment.
Yes.
There's a certain amount of truth to that. It's not just the politicians, though. It's also the user groups who have a major stake in continuing the existing pattern of use. But I think I wouldn't agree with you that everything is known out there. When I began working on this subject with a hydrologist at Arizona some years back, we started locally and we wrote about a river that was going dry in Arizona. And
which
then
one?
The San Pedro River.
It's the one that starts in Mexico?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the perhaps the most important birding area in the lower 48 states. It's an extraordinary resource. And we started working on that because we had already seen another river, the Santa Cruz in Tucson, go dry from groundwater pumping. So we did a critique of that, and then we went further afield, and we started to write about the West. But it was in the context of doing that that I realized that there was this huge national problem, and no one was talking about it. So if you were to look to Water Follies, what you'll find in there are stories involving Florida, Massachusetts, my home state, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin. These are some of the wettest places in the United States. And yet, to go back to Massachusetts, the Ipswich River there has gone dry in 4 of the last 8 years. And the reason is groundwater pumping. Now, I was shocked, and I'm an expert in the field. So I decided that I needed to write a book on the subject, and it's the first book ever written on the subject. There's never even been a magazine article on the subject. There are obscure journal articles, some of which I've written. There are USGS monographs.
Well, doesn't the US EPA have an Office of Groundwater, though?
They have an Office of Groundwater, sir, but what's never been linked is the connection of groundwater pumping to the surface supply. So you can find occasional comments in obscure government reports. But I like to say the first thing that we need to figure out or need to understand is that this is a problem, and we need to start talking about it.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, that I guess we go back to the almost to the place where we started, though, that what you have to do is get people out of the mindset that says, well, we can continue to pump. We can pump as much as we want. And it's never going to run out. It seems that's still what, you know, you're bumping up against this idea that it's this big, it's like there's an ocean and it's under the ground there and we're never going to be able to exhaust it. And clearly that's not true for, first of all. And then there's this other issue that you say, you know, people need to make this understanding of, you know, aside from the fact that it is that groundwater is finite, there is this relationship between the groundwater and the surface water, and what you do with that excessive pumping does indeed have consequences on the surface, sort of apart from that idea that one day we might just run out of groundwater.
I agree, David, with both of your comments, and this links back the disconnect between law and science, because the scientists tell us that groundwater and surface water are not separate species. It simply describes the location of water in the hydrologic cycle. At some point, groundwater becomes surface water, and then later in the cycle, surface water returns to groundwater. But the legal system has different sets of rules. Now, this is not just to blame judges, but because when the rules developed, it was in the 19th century when the science of hydrology was in its infancy, and people did not understand the connection between ground and surface water. So at that point, the judges said, well, if you can get it out of the ground, then it's yours. Unfortunately, the science of hydrology has now taught us that there is a connect, but the legal system has not kept pace with that. So now we find ourselves in a situation where the rules encourage this over-exploitation. And what needs to happen is we need to set limits on this unfettered ability under state law to put in a pump pretty much anywhere and anywhere one wants. That cannot be is not sustainable, and it's creating immense environmental harms.
Mm. I want to again. I think that some of the stories that you offer in the book give people an opportunity to connect to and relate to this issue. We talked a little bit earlier. You mentioned just how important groundwater is for drinking for people. That is, when they go and they turn on the tap, the water that comes out there. Another of the stories that you tell, though, in the book has to do with, not with tap water, it has to do with bottled water. One of our big things nowadays. That here in this town, for example, we have good water. You know, you can go and get good water out of the tap, but people are still going out and going down to the store and buying water in a bottle. And that's not just here, but it happens all over the place. Here, again, this is another one of these cases where a lot of water has been pumped on a groundwater, has been pumped and then put into bottles and sold.
It's wonderfully perverse. and another reason why the book is called Water Follies. You're absolutely right, David. Bottled water. Gosh, no one used to drink bottled water. There used to be the little water cooler around the office where gossip was exchanged and the like. But it's become a cultural phenomenon in the United States, and it's had explosive growth. Whenever I walk into a classroom now, right next to the laptop is the student's bottled water. You go to the gym, everyone's drinking bottled water. You go to the movie theater. I mean, have you priced bottled water in the movies lately? It's more expensive than the popcorn. In fact, bottled water is now selling for more than milk, oil, gasoline, or things made with water like Coca-Cola. It's been an explosive growth. One of the chief beneficiaries of this is Perrier. Now, I thought Perrier was the importer of little green bottles of spring water from France, but Perrier is actually the largest U.S. bottler of water. They're a subsidiary of the Swiss-based food giant Nestle, and they've just renamed their North American waters company Nestle Waters North America. But you'd never know it because they sell under different brands. Ice Mountain, Calistoga, Arrowhead, Zephyr Hills, Poland Spring are all Perrier subsidiaries. Mm-hmm. And the story I tell is about a river in Wisconsin with a spring nearby. And the state of Wisconsin has wonderful natural resources, and they've been trying to protect the McCann River for, gosh, almost a half century. And all of a sudden, Perrier came in and said, well, we want to put in a well located immediately adjacent to this spring, like 60 feet from the spring. And we want to pump 270 million gallons of water a year from this well and sell it and move it out of state to our consumers elsewhere. And there was little, actually nothing, that the state of Wisconsin could do under Wisconsin law, because Wisconsin law said, if you want to put in a well, you go right ahead. And I'd just like to make the point, there's nothing wrong with drinking bottled water. In fact, every physician would tell us that we don't drink enough water. It's certainly better for you than Coke or many other things that we drink. But there's a disconnect between state policy of trying to protect natural resources and letting Perrier or anyone else, for that matter, come in and appropriate hundreds of millions of gallons of water, especially when that pumping would have devastating consequences on the state's natural resources.
We have some other callers. Next person in line is in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Years ago, it was Waukesha water. It was famous. I have a question maybe you can answer. Occasionally, I hear on the news that Milwaukee is dumping raw sewage in Lake Michigan. I don't know if they do that all the time. Is it treated, or is it occasionally? Would you know the answer to that?
Oh, they certainly are not. That would subject them to immense fines from the EPA.
Huh?
In fact, one of the great success stories in environmental law in the United States is the Clean Water Act. Decades ago, cities used to routinely dump raw sewage into rivers.
Right.
There was this curious notion that the water would dilute the sewage and somehow or other purify it. Well, of course, it didn't. And you may remember all the way back to the 1960s, a river in Ohio, the Cuyahoga, actually caught fire from all of the industrial solvents that have been dumped into the river. But the Clean Water Act has pretty much eliminated all of that. You will occasionally get sewage going into water courses today, but that's usually when there's some very severe storm that overtaxes the sewer system and the wastewater treatment plant. Other than that, we've really done a wonderful job of protecting our rivers from sewage. The chapter that remains unfinished has to do with runoff from farms, because you can have a lot of pesticides and fertilizers applied to farmland, and then the rainstorm comes along and it washes a lot of the stuff into the river, and that creates immense problems.
We have, here in Cook County, we have a forest preserve with a hand pump out there. I don't know if it's still there. And they claim that the water at that hand pump comes all the way from Canada through an aquifer. Is that a myth, or is it possible?
Well, the water from the hand pump's immediately coming from whatever is right below the pump.
Yeah.
But the hand pump's a great illustration, because water only moves by energy. And one of the energies is your arm. When you go to that pump and you start to crank it, eventually you'll get enough pressure to bring it up. Well, water will also move by gravity. And so if you pump water from underneath that hand pump out, then water somewhat further afield from that hand pump will move toward the hand pump.
I see. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Other caller here in Belgium, which is over by Danville, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a few comments about and questions about this, but to start off with, talk about the nonsense with bottled water. A company that I'm sure you all drink over there in Champaign, we drink here, is kind of Absolut in their names. They get their water right out of the Champaign tap, you know, and put it in the bottle and away it goes. Maybe they filtered a little bit more, but that's it. So you're paying for it to come to the tap, but you're willing to go out and buy it. It's been put in a bottle. Makes you scratch your head, doesn't it?
Aren't we an amazing species?
Yes, aren't we?
I like to say that we human beings have an infinite capacity to deny reality.
Exactly. The other thing I was pointing out is that over here along the Wabash River, there's a large paper mill. And this paper mill has a very large diameter well that goes down into a fabulous aquifer that runs along the Wabash. And they pump many, many gallons of water out to use in their process there, and it doesn't make sense. There's a river running right by, but yet they pump the water from the aquifer to use. It must be exactly like you say, the water in the Wabash is more regulated than the water in the ground.
I wish I could speak with some expertise on the situation, sir. I can't, but that's my suspicion as well. Yeah. One of the things that is happening, at least in the West now, is looking to reuse municipal effluent for industrial purposes, for parks, golf courses, turf irrigation, and the like. And what people around the country have come, including Massachusetts, my home state, have come to realize is that water that's gone through the wastewater treatment plant is too valuable to throw away and get rid of. It needs to be kept locally and made good use of.
I've always wondered why, you know, when I was a young lad, my grandparents had cisterns that they utilized the water that came off their roofs and stuff. That's something that's not even used at all anymore. And we have so much asphalt and roofs and stuff that we could catch that water. Now, we would deny it from the rivers, but at least we wouldn't be utilizing some of the groundwater the way it is.
Well, that's a terrific point. Let me break it down into two. The development that's occurred is actually limiting our groundwater supply. Because to the extent that you have roadways and rooftops and other impermeable concrete or other surfaces, when the rainstorm comes, the water doesn't absorb it like a sponge and then allow gravity to move it downward through the soil to the aquifer. Instead, it runs off, and it goes to the river, but the river water is moving very quickly. There's nothing to restrict the flow of river water, and it's all of a sudden a flood event or something that moves water dramatically more quickly out of the area. And the consequence of that is you're actually interfering with the groundwater supply. As for the cistern comment, sir, you're absolutely right. And what for me that illustrates is that we do not recognize the value of water. We don't price water appropriately. We don't recognize it as having any economic value. And as a consequence, people don't care about it, and people don't treat it with the respect that this precious resource deserves. If water were priced appropriately, people would start to think about cutting down on profligate water use. They might think about ways to conserve, including your suggestion of cisterns.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. Other questions are welcome. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Robert Glennon. He's professor of law at the University of Arizona and has written a lot on water issues. He's one of the country's leading authorities, in fact, on water law. He has written a book that looks specifically at groundwater. His book is titled Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. And it's published by the Island Press, and in which he points out the ever-increasing rate at which we're pumping groundwater. People use it to drink. It's used for agriculture. It's used in industry. And the fact that people don't often appreciate that there's a connection. It's all part of one system. There's a connection between the groundwater and the surface water. And there have been places around this country where they have pumped lots and lots of water out of the ground, and it has affected surface water, streams and lakes and rivers. And if you're interested in reading about that story, you can go out and take a look at the book. And questions are welcome, too, here on the show. We have several people ready, and we'll get right to them. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, here where we are, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Now with Bill Moyers on PBS a couple of weeks ago, had a story about Coca-Cola buying up, putting in a well in India and drying up the water supply for 2 miles around so the people had no water. And we're talking about people who have to hand carry water. So it's going on not just here, but everywhere.
That's one of the worst places is India, also China as well. And it's profoundly changing the nature of local economies, which have been subsisting farming of folks of very modest means on very small plots. And the movement to put in wells is a very capital-intensive development that basically prices out all of the local citizens. And it's having not only an impact on individual domestic wells, but also the kind of environmental consequences that I write about in Water Follies. That is, it's affecting local rivers. And it creates a double whammy because the rivers have been the source of water for drinking and other supplies downstream, and yet now, because of the groundwater pumping, there's less water going downstream.
I don't know that you've mentioned this, but one of the things that happens with the groundwater is that the ground, as the water filters through it, the ground actually acts as a filter, cleaning out a number of impurities. It doesn't get everything, obviously, but it's often a better quality water than surface water.
That's absolutely right. Your point is one of the reasons why people have turned to groundwater instead of surface water, because surface water often has higher content of salts, or it can have a higher content of just soil that the rainwater washes into the river and needs additional filtration. So groundwater has been a very high quality water. The problem, though, is that the further down from beneath the ground you pump the water, the more the water degrades in quality. And this is, an interesting phenomenon. You get fluoride, radon, and some other not very nice stuff occurring in the aquifer. And it's simply a function of the Earth's internal temperature being higher from further down. And stuff goes into solution at those lower depths that would not be in solution if you were pumping from more shallow areas.
Somebody, I call into one of Focus 580's shows, I believe it was, said that our local aquifer had dropped 50 feet. I don't know whether that's correct or not, or in what time period. But that seems like a lot to me in an area where it has a fair amount of rain and a really nice aquifer. And I have a relative who's an engineer in the eastern part of Washington State. I'm not sure exactly what he does. He's not a close relative. And I commented to him on a recent visit of his in this direction that our aquifer had dropped. He said, oh, all you have to do is pump the water back in when you're not using it so much. I thought,
well, that's...
Oh, my. Where
aren't,
do I start?
Aren't engineers fun? Of course, as a lawyer, I love lawyer jokes. But I think that lawyer jokes are best told by a member of the family. But engineer jokes are a lot of fun, too. But since I'm not a member of the family, I'll spare you them. You'll have to read the book for a few of those.
Okay, thanks a bunch.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Actually, there's something else that we really have not... I mean, we got some other calls, we'll get to them, but something else that we really haven't talked about, another consequence of this kind of pumping of groundwater, and that is subsidence, which has happened, too. And I think you only have to look to Mexico City to see just how dramatic something like that can be.
That's absolutely right, David, and I've got a couple of photographs in the book that show that as well. Subsidence in the San Joaquin Valley of California has dropped land 30 or 40 feet from the 1920s to the 1970s. In Arizona, we're seeing large fissures develop from subsidence. Subsidence is kind of interesting. I liken it to a box of cornflakes. And when you go to the supermarket and you buy a box of cornflakes, you bring it home, you open it up, and the first thing you think is, Kellogg's ripped me off. It's like it's already a third gone. It's like I haven't had one bowl of cereal. Well, imagine if Kellogg's had packaged those cornflakes and had added a couple of cups of milk to the cornflakes. Well, when you use a straw and you extract the milk from the cornflakes box, that's the equivalent of pumping groundwater. And then the flakes of corn or the soil settles because there's nothing to support it. In other areas of the country, in Florida in particular, there are these huge sinkholes that developed. It's a completely different geological formation called limestone, karst limestone, former underground or former ocean bed. And there are people who have had sinkholes appear in their yards, and the insurance company has come out, and I chronicle one of these in the book, come out and said, well, we'll fix this for you. And they've brought in a contractor who's poured a cubic yard of concrete. Now, anyone who's worked with concrete, and you imagine 3 by 3 by 3, that's one heck of a lot of concrete. They pour the cubic yard of concrete into the sinkhole, and it disappeared. They kept pouring and pouring and pouring until they had poured 108 cubic yards of concrete into this one hole in this one yard. Florida has a huge problem.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'm talking with Robert Glennon from University of Arizona. We have some other callers. We'll try to get to them as many as we can. Remember, some settling of contents does occur during shipment. Let's go on here to line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I just wanted to add a comment to this bottled water thing that you described a little earlier in the conversation. My first job out of graduate school was in central Iowa, and I was moving there from the East Coast. And when I arrived in this small college town, I just could not drink the tap water. This was the early 1980s. So I would go to the store and get what was called then just a bottle of distilled water, a huge, huge 2-gallon thing, and just put it in the refrigerator. But the local population there was drinking this water forever, and they didn't seem to taste the difference. But I was wondering, because, you know, the previous caller was bringing up the whole question about what is it that's filtered out of water, what isn't filtered out of water. But this was a small college town, but it was a farming community. And I was told that some of the runoff from the farming chemicals was causing the water to taste bad. But but then I moved here to Champaign, and there didn't seem to be that problem. And I carry bottled water just because I'm thirsty. It's not a fashion statement. But I just wondered about the farming chemicals.
Your question is an excellent one, and it's a very serious problem. And Iowa is one of those places. It's not necessarily that the pesticides or fertilizers have run off into rivers so much as that they've percolated into the ground. Mm. And some of these chemicals, while the soil can filter some of the things from water, it does not often filter pesticides and fertilizers. And so the farming community is literally poisoning itself with its own applications.
Yeah.
As for what's filtered out, it depends on the kind of filtration process you use. Every municipal plant has primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment, and then they add either usually chlorine as a final disinfectant to it. When you go to the store now and you buy, Coke's gone in the business, so is Pepsi. They've got Aquafina and Dasani. When you buy that, it's run through what's called reverse osmosis, very high-tech filters that push the water need a lot of energy, push the water through these filters, and it captures basically everything on one side.
Mm.
That's what you would call distilled water.
Oh.
So it has essentially no taste.
Mm-hmm.
People swear by waters in different sections of the country and the world for health benefits, for taste benefits, and I think for people with sensitive palates, there are some very, very substantial differences.
Yeah,
but I agree with David here that often people are drinking bottled water when it's really no more than the tap water that's been filtered and in many instances filtered unnecessarily.
Mm. Well, I know. It was early 1980s, and that tap water just tasted terrible. So when I moved here, I didn't seem to have that problem. But okay.
Well, you got to go with your instinct and your taste. If it didn't taste good to you, why would you continue to drink it?
Yeah, I just thought I was going to make myself sick if I drank it too much. So, okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Right. We'll go to Aurora for our next caller, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I have a list of four things. I just wondered when the washing machine companies are going to put out water-saving devices. I know that Sears has one, but you don't get them. And there's a lot of good soapy water that can be used again.
Oh, can we talk about that one right away? You're talking about one of my pet peeves. We could, if we valued water appropriately, reuse that water. It's what's called gray water. It's not water that's gone through your toilet system. It's just water that's been used for some household purpose. And yet it could be used very much for outside landscaping and all kinds of things about the yard. But we don't value water appropriately. We don't even price it.
Oh, I know that. That's one of the things that bothers me the most, because I know some people, that's all they do for their fun of their lives. They wash clothes twice a day.
That sounds like a horrible life to me. But can I tell you a little bit about this water pricing thing? When you get your water bill, and I don't care whether you get your water bill from the municipal water department under the political auspices of the mayor and the council or whatever the form of government you have there, or whether you get water from a public utility regulated by the Public Utility Commission of the state, whichever it is, when you look at your bill, you're actually not paying anything for the water. The rate components of that bill are actually all that go into the cost of actually distributing the water. You're paying for the pipes, you're paying for the employees' salaries and benefits, you're paying for the overhead for the utility to have a building and a billing department and all of the rest of that. But with very few exceptions in the United States, there is no commodity charge for water. Now think about that. That's the next
time. Well, my bill is about $27, and then I pay $15 for a wastewater bill. So I have two water bills.
You do, but let's take the first one. The $27 is actually not for the water.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Could I say another comment?
Sure.
And these people that shower all day, they go someplace, they have to shower, they come back, they have to shower. I just get so tired of people saying, I have to shower. You know, and maybe they've done it twice already.
Let me build on that comment. In the mid-19th century in Chicago, people used between 3 and 5 gallons per capita per day. Today we use 60, 80 gallons, 150 gallons per capita per day. And it's all about taking showers, having washing machines in the house, and one of my actual pet peeves is using it for getting rid of human waste. Think about that. Take water out of the ground and you mix fecal matter with it. What are we doing?
And
what is the solution to that?
Overall, I think the caller asks the right point. And that if we're undervaluing it, if we're not paying enough, if we're wasting it, if we're treating it as if, well, we can just use as much as we want and it's never going to run out, what do we do about that? That means changing the way people think at a very fundamental level, which is not an easy thing to do.
I think there's a couple of different approaches here. On the one hand, we need some government rules and regulations to curb really excessive water use. We need government rules that restrict access to this finite supply. We cannot continue to let new straws go into the single milkshake glass. The second thing, though, and it has to be a partnership in my judgment, is that we need to have market forces work. We need to recognize that there are aspects of water that are private property rights. We need to make those rights quantified, and then we need to make them transferable so that someone who has water rights can sell those water rights to a user who will make a more valuable use of them. And that's the way to break the cycle. If you want to come along, say Perrier, and put in a bottled water plant, well, that's not a bad thing. But you're going to have to buy up someone else's water rights. You're going to have to pinch some other straws and remove those straws from the milkshake glass before you get a right to put in a new straw.
Hmm. Well, we'll try and get some other callers, at least one more. This next person in line is Champagne, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, I have a case study that exemplifies the importance of aquifers and the consequences of drawing them down. Throughout the Southeast, longleaf pines are a species of tree that have very long tap roots, and they're now restricted to very dry habitats there. And there's cases where adult longleaf pines are dying because their tap root is out of reach of the aquifer that has been drawn down so far. And I guess I'd point out, too, that the red-cockaded woodpecker, which is a federally endangered species, depends exclusively on longleaf pines for nesting. And so I guess my point is that, you know, when people draw water, it could be even miles away, it has consequences throughout the various ecosystems.
Absolutely it does, sir. And I've been following the longleaf pine story. It didn't make it into Water Follies, but I'd like to learn more about it. I have stories from the Southeast as well. The Apalachicola River in Georgia that flows from Georgia into Florida is one of those. What I could not agree more with you.
Yep.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. There is a even bigger issue here, and I suppose really it is the one that the symposium here is all about, and that is this notion of balancing private interest and public good. And the fact that we have tended, I think that balance has tended to tip in the direction of private property and individual rights. And we don't seem to, we seem to have a hard time thinking of this idea that there are certain resources that are too big and too important to say they just belong to a few people, that somehow that they belong to everyone.
That's right, and water is one of those resources. There's nothing wrong with recognizing private rights in water, but those rights are still subject to government regulation and control, because ultimately it's a right of use of the water. It's not an ownership of the water itself. And therefore, government rules and regulations that restrict access to this public supply are entirely appropriate. The problem with the existing situation in most states is that it's a public resource that to which we allow limitless access for private use. That's the irony.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there. I will say, first of all, to people who are interested in reading more on this issue, look for the book that we have been talking about by our guest, Robert Glennon. Again, the title of the book is Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. It's published by the Island Press. Our guest, Robert Glennon, is professor of law at University of Arizona. He is here to take part in a symposium on this campus, Owning Nature, Private Property and the Public Interest. That will be held this afternoon from 2 to 5 in the auditorium of the Law School building on the U of I campus. It is free and open to the public. Anyone who would like to attend, feel free to go down there. And thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.